Is stagflation on the horizon for America? Easy to overreact, of course, but the latest GDP numbers showed a significant slowdown, and there are worrying signs of inflation holding its own. What will that do to the euphoria around the Magnificent Seven, with Alphabet and Microsoft having just reported after the US close? And what about Australia's CPI numbers from Wednesday? Not exactly welcome, were they? A bit of catching up to do this morning. It's Friday, the 26th of April, 2024. It's the Morning Call from NAB. Good morning. Well, US stocks didn't have a good day. The S&P finished down 0.5%, 0.6% lower for the Nasdaq, 1% down for the Dow. Also in Europe, a 1% drop in the Euro Stoxx 50, but a 0.5% rise in the FTSE 100. US Treasury yields are quite a bit higher, up 6 basis points this morning to 4.7%, up 6 basis points in Canada as well, up 4 in Germany. Yields up 3 basis points for 10-year gilt yields in the UK. Aussie 10-year yields are now up to 4.52%. on futures. That's a full 12 basis points higher than where we left them off last time. And the US dollar is down a third of 1% today, but most of that is wiping out the gains from the day before. The Aussie is up 0.3% this morning. It did get up to 65.3 US cents, but fell below 64.9. It's now back up to 65.2. So a bit of yo-yo action. And oil is rising, a 1.3% increase in Brent crude, up over 89 a barrel again. WTI is up 1.1%. So it's Rodrigo Cotril on today from NAB in Sydney. There is a bit happening since we were last on, most noticeably the surprise fall in US GDP growth and a kick up in core PCE prices as well for the quarter. So the drop in GDP, quite marked, wasn't it? From 3.4% growth quarter on quarter, these are the headline numbers, to 1.6%. I think 2.5% was what was expected. So quite a downside surprise.
Morning, Phil. Yes, a big, big surprise in terms of the GDP print. And when you look at the details, it's quite interesting because the consumer was weaker than expected, but still quite solid at around 2.5%. And the market was looking for a contribution of a gain of 3%. But one of the themes that we have been highlighting as well for the course of 2024 was that we should be expecting a reduction in government spending. And that was quite evident as well in the data compared to, you know, how much spending the government incurred over 2023. So this idea of a fiscal drag, if you like, over the course of 2024 seems to be, you know, happening. And many are suggesting that those defense expenses are also likely to contract over the course of this year. So more of the same, in a sense, should be expected as well. And the other aspect as well was the issue around investment. If you remember, in 2023, investment was a big contributor to growth. And now we're seeing a bit of a pullback in those numbers. So it's been a bit sluggish. Although we're still seeing residential investment as supporting the economy as well. So overall, there's big surprises there. And importantly, too, if you remember, typically some, you know, surprises in GDP tend to be inventories that tend to move things around and that you get a payback next time. This time around, whilst inventories were a little bit weaker, they're not really the source or the real source for the weakness, so or weaker than expected numbers. So it's a bit more credible and places the view that maybe it's more sustainable as well.
So nothing's getting pushed back, in other words, and prices going up as well. I mean, is this a total surprise? Because, I mean, we've been seeing weaker ISM, haven't we, for manufacturing and services? So the indicators were there.
I mean, if anything, those PMIs, or, you know, we've seen those weaker PMIs, and we'll wait for the ISMs next week. I kind of painting you the picture for what to expect over Q2 as well. So it's probably worth emphasizing that, if anything, it's playing to the view that, you know, if you remember, we had a very strong Q3, close to 5% GDP. Then Q4 was very strong at 3.5. Now we have 1.5. And the way we're traveling, it seems reasonable to expect even weaker, if not very similar, soft GDP growth, which is just below that trend growth as well. So that's the one story. And as you say, in terms of the inflation number, that upward surprise in the core reading, you know, it remains to be seen how it's actually composed. We will get more details tomorrow in terms of the expenditure as well as the inflation number, the core PCE for March. But the sort of the if you like the rough read through, it means that if there hasn't been any upward revisions to January and February, then it means that inflation in during March ticked a lot higher at 0.48 compared to the 0.3 expected by the market. So that would be one important aspect to bear in mind in terms of the information we get on tonight. The other equation is that maybe there's been massive upward revisions to January and February, and March maybe wasn't as hot as expected. So that detail will be important tonight to just to get a sense of the trend, if you like, the monthly trend in the inflation dynamics in the US. But certainly a lot stronger than expected. And the question is whether March will reveal a little bit of cooling or an acceleration in that inflation dynamic.
And then April, well, we've got this introduction, the 1st of April, the minimum wages for fast food workers in California has gone up from $16 to $20 an hour. It's quite a hike as well. So, you know, assume that's going to have a bit of an impact. So putting all of this together, we've got rising prices, we've got falling growth. I mean, are we heading towards, is there a stagflation danger for the United States?
Well, you know, you could argue that certainly the risk of that scenario is increasing. You know, if you think about trend growth for the U.S. being just below 2%, 1.6 is not high enough, if you like. So that will certainly play to the view that lower growth, and whilst inflation remains sticky. So certainly, yes, you can make that argument. But we're not there yet, but certainly the risk is increasing.
Yeah, and with 2-year yields now hovering around the 5% mark, I mean, what's this doing for the timing of cuts or expectations of the timing for cuts? Has it pushed it back much?
Well, if anything, that's kind of the contrast of reactions, if you like, is that the U.S. Treasury market has certainly pushed out those expectations of rate cuts with the, I think it's only 34 basis point priced in, which would be the lowest that we've seen in a very long time in terms of rate cut expectations. Whilst at the same time, you look at the reaction of the equity market and they didn't like the number. And so it's this dynamic playing to the stagflation view, if you like, that the market is thinking, well, the economy is slowing, but inflation remains elevated and therefore the Fed cannot cut. And then for that sort of dual mandate for that the Fed has, you probably need weaker GDP growth for that equation to change. And at the moment, it just means that the Fed needs to stay high for longer. And similarly, you know, adding to that, we had those jobless claims numbers, which gives you a sense of, you know, any potential weakness in the labor market ahead. And it was actually, you know, pretty solid. We saw those claims actually come down a little bit to 207, whilst the market was looking for 215. So there's no evidence yet of a significant weakness in the labor market, which again would be a trigger for the Fed to maybe do a trade-off between inflation and growth. And at the moment, that trade-off is not there.
And U.S. durable goods orders, they were strong on Wednesday night as well, up 2.6% in March. So, you know, seems like it's going the other way, but then take out non-defense aircraft and it's just 0.2% growth. So obviously people were out buying Boeing aircraft that month, although their earnings didn't show it. They weren't too hot, were they, this week? So I would just wonder, just while we're looking at share prices, and we'll talk about, you know, what today's board in just a second. But, you know, can America continue to enjoy high prices on the Magnificent Seven if we do see the economy slow? I mean, Meta posted a strong earning result on Wednesday night in the United States. They're $36.5 billion revenue for Q1. That was a beat by about $400 million. Earnings per share was stronger too. We'll tell you about Alphabet and Microsoft in a second. But I wonder whether this latest economic data will weigh on the expectations for, you know, for big tech or for the share market generally in the United States.
Yes. And if anything, you know, obviously the big tech has been a big driver for the performance of the equity market. And sadly, the Meta story, of course, is that whilst all those earnings numbers were pretty decent, the increase in spending and capex was the one that disappointed. So, and the, you know, big drop of 11% was significant. So it again shows how elevated expectations are in terms of those earnings and projections, which, you know, puts a risk to the downside if any numbers disappoint. Whilst at the same time, you know, many of these companies are dependent on a solid consumer in the US. And at the moment, we're starting to see a little bit of a slowdown of that level of strength or consumption from the consumer as well.
Well, it does seem a lot's going the wrong way, doesn't it? So, because a bit of a worry in Canada as well, average earnings there in February rose from 3.7% up to 4.5% year on year. So that's a few warning signs around the place, aren't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably worth emphasizing though that just like in Canada and in other places, that exceptionalism is not happening. So the big story is, of course, is that the US is not only growing and performing very well, but you know, inflation remains elevated, whilst in other parts like in Canada, Europe, and even the UK now, you know, we're seeing that slowdown, or the slowdown in growth is pretty evident, but now we're also seeing that cooling in terms of price pressures. So that's a difference. And that's why we're obviously seeing rate cut expectations for Europe and now Canada as well, likely to occur over the second half of this year, whilst in the US they look a little bit more questionable, if you like.
So Australia's inflation, CPI came down from 4.1% to 3.6%, the headline rate, but it was expected to fall a lot further than that, wasn't it? In fact, Q on Q, up 1% from 0.6% last time. So that's a concern.
It is a concern, and it's 0.2 higher than what the consensus was expecting. So if anything, you know, it does kind of mean that the RBA will have to revise its inflation projections in May when we get a new set of numbers. And also worth remembering that, you know, the RBA talked about those concerns of the labor market last month. And obviously we also got a much stronger labor market report. So again, those concerns look premature, whilst at the same time, the expectations for the inflation to cool down in Australia is now also looking at risk that maybe that progress is stalling and it's not happening as quickly as the RBA would like. So certainly a lot of thinking that for the RBA, particularly in terms of its guidance. So that will be an important consideration for the May meeting.
Right. And then Europe, yes, I mean, sooner than rather than later, maybe the next to go. And yet, you know, the German IFO numbers, they did improve a bit, still all below 100 though, which, you know, the point at which it goes from bad to good. But expectations have moved from 87.7 to 89.9. So a bit of a move between March and April. And the business climate's gone from 87.9 to 89.4. So heading in the right direction. But then Isabel Schnabel from the ECB has been talking about this bumpy last mile. The biggest concern is clearly services inflation, she said, and productivity. She said we've had negative productivity growth now over several quarters. And that is a concern. Can you fix that with monetary policy, I wonder?
No, but it does mean that you have to be cautious about, you know, rate cuts. And if anything, that's the same argument here in Australia. You know, productivity is not great. We're nowhere near where we need to be in terms of those levels. And therefore, cutting too soon is a risk. And it forces, you know, a little bit of cautiousness for central banks before, you know, pulling the trigger. So now in terms of the dynamics, the growth dynamics is probably worth highlighting too, because of the reaction of currencies, is that we're starting to see a little bit of that exceptionalism of the US being, you know, eroded, if you like, whilst at the same time, we're also starting to see a little bit of improvement of growth elsewhere. You mentioned Europe, the activity readings are suggesting we should expect some improvement there. And of course, China is improving as well, albeit, you know, with a lot of question marks as to whether that improvement can be sustained. But certainly, and even in other parts of Asia, we're also seeing growth improving. So again, plays into that idea that maybe the US dollar strength, which has been, you know, supported by the U.S. exceptionalism, could start to get eroded, even though the Fed may have to cut a little bit later than expected.
You are leading me in the right direction here. Here's the segue, Rodrigo, because that is not the case, obviously, for the yen. Over 155 yen, yes, to the dollar now, breaking records almost every day, it seems. We get Tokyo CPI numbers out just a few hours before the Bank of Japan's decision today and their quarterly report as well. So what are we expecting? I mean, they must be worried about the currency. Are they going to do anything about it?
Well, that's really the debate, you know, and I think that in many ways, you know, you could argue that the weakness of the yen Is the market telling the bank that, you know, your pace of policy normalization is too slow? There's a reason why the yen is weak today. And if you're really concerned about JPY weakness, not only from its inflationary impact, but from a stability perspective as well, we've seen reports of exporters now complaining that the currency is too low because it's having an impact on the imports that they need. And therefore, you know, the bank has all the tools and abilities to fix the problem. They could give a bit more guidance in terms of, you know, the expectation of how quickly policy or interest rates should rise in Japan. Expectations are that the forecast, for instance, in terms of the update, will show that the bank will expect inflation to range around that 2% target over the forecast horizon. So from that perspective, you could say, well, if you believe that you have achieved your inflation goal, then you should be lifting your policy rate back to a normal level, and that will be very helpful for the yen. Whilst at the same time, you know, we got to remember that the QE program in Japan is still very, very solid. And again, any guidance in terms of a slowdown of that QE or like QT would also be very helpful. So,
which is very possible, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah, expectations are that they will at least give a hint, if not a proper guidance, in terms of a reduction of the pace of JGB purchases. But many people obviously like to remind everyone that, you know, when it comes to Japan, the relationship of the bank and the government is a lot closer than in many other places. Whilst at the same time, you know, we got to remember that the government will be very sensitive to increases in JGBs, given the level of debt that they have. So it's all a very sort of, you know, delicate exercise, but certainly there's this room there for at least some pullback in the pace of buying of JGBs.
So room for a surprise is what we're saying today, isn't it, really, from the Bank of Japan.
Room for disappointment, because I think the market will certainly test the resolve if they don't do something, particularly given the fact that we now have 10-year treasury yields trading at 470. You know, there's reasons why the yen should be weaker. And if the bank doesn't provide any, you know, supportive guidance, then the yen is at risk of
how low can it go? Exactly. The ECB Consumer Expectations Survey as well today. We talked about the PCE deflator numbers. Of course, the inflation numbers the Fed likes to use, and the personal income and spending numbers as well. What else have we got? The University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey as well, including that 5 to 10 year inflation expectation result that was sitting at 3% last time. So that's all coming up. But let me tell you. We've got the results from Alphabet and Microsoft. Alphabet doing exceedingly well, issuing their first ever dividend, actually. Fancy that. Plus a $70 billion share buyback. Earnings per share, $1.89. The estimate was $1.53, so a beat on that and on revenue. $80.54 billion versus an estimate of $79.04 billion. Shares up more than 10% in after-hours trade. And a similar story with Microsoft, also doing much better than expected thanks to AI and their cloud offerings, all doing well. Revenue in the last quarter, finishing March, rose 17% to 61.9 billion against expectations of 60.9 billion, and you know, just a billion more. While profit was 294 against expectations of 283, so per share, so a beat all round. And again, shares up well over 10% in after hours trade. The Magnificent Seven. There's no stopping them, is there? So thanks for that. Thanks for joining us this morning, Rodrigo.
Great. Thanks, Phil. Talk next week. Cheers.
And in the weekend edition later on today, managing Australia's energy transition with Alison Reeve from the Grattan Institute.
Yeah. So if Australia maintains its current share of the so-called critical minerals, so the minerals that are needed for the energy transition, which are sort of lithium, nickel, cobalt, zinc, copper, and some of the rare earth metals, if we maintain our current market share percentage-wise, with the projected growth that's needed to do the global energy transition, we will actually more than replace the income that we get from thermal and metallurgical coal.
Which is all good news, of course. But what if something new comes along, like sodium ion batteries, or if hydrogen becomes more prevalent? What do we do then? And how do we move up the value chain so we're not just extracting resources and shipping them out? It's a fascinating discussion on this weekend's Weekend Weekend Edition, available from this afternoon, wherever you got this podcast from. Join me for that, along with Alison Reeves, and I am back on Monday as well for another NAB Morning Call. I'm Phil Dobby for NAB. Thanks for joining me today.